Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Tonight is the night of the last presidential debate, and this is the place. Hofstra University in Hempstead on Long Island. Look at the Daily News cover, and you will see the stakes in cartoon form. Did you see it? It's the last chance saloon for John McCain, it says. And take a look at Newsday. All eyes on Long Island. And inside the New York Times, on what would have been page one of the Metro section, if they still had a Metro section, Hofstra University is agog over the presidential debate on its turf. Who here is agog? Who here uses the word agog in your everyday conversation? That's how the New York Times speaks. I'm not sure it's how regular people speak. And for those of you listening on the radio, let me describe the scene here at Dempster Hall. We are in a television studio on campus. They teach broadcasting here. We're in the building of the campus radio station as well. Anyone here work at the campus radio station? What are the call letters? W-H-U-R? R-H-U, W-R-H-U at 88.7 FM, right? Okay, so if you're in Hempstead, you can hear 88.7. The school is actually closed here at Hofstra today for security reasons with the debate tonight, but a few professors and people from high schools in the area colluded with us to ask the students to come to the show here this morning. In fact, let me rephrase that. Some asked, some made it mandatory for a number of students, though I gather they do get some extra credit for attending, so I'd say that coercion and bribery are both alive and well in academia on Long Island. We welcome students and professors from Hofstra and from the University of Lomé in the West African nation of Togo who are here today. And a little closer to home, we welcome teachers and students from Jericho High School, Garden City High School, and West Islip High School, many of whom are in attendance today. So let's chat a little bit with some of the people here. And let's start with Sid Nathan, a senior here at Hofstra, and Drew Bennett, also a senior. They are both on the debate team. Drew's a McCain supporter, Sid's for Obama, and they are both members of POISE, which stands for Professional Organization in Speech Education. Hi, Siddhartha. Hi, Drew.
How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Tell us about yourself a little bit. Drew, where'd you grow up? How'd you become a Republican?
Born and raised right here in Uniondale. Been at Hofstra pretty much my whole entire life. Became a Republican pretty much. I got involved in the political process starting in about 2000. 9/11 being a New Yorker, being a local kid, that certainly hit me hard. Got me involved politically, and I guess most of my ideology has resulted from the years and the studies, both that I've done in high school and that have followed me here.
Uniondale, how many times in your life have you been to the Nassau Coliseum?
Hundreds.
Islanders
let's,
fan?
Let's go Islanders.
My sympathies to all Islanders fans.
Thank you.
Sid, how about you? Where'd you grow up? How'd you come to be a Democrat?
New Haven, Connecticut is where I grew up. I came to be a Democrat when my father said to me in 1991, "These crazy Republicans are screwing things up."
That was it.
That was the turning point.
Whatever happened to collegiate rebellion?
I don't know. I just kind of stuck through with my parents. It turned out to be the right view in my mind.
Drew, do you feel the outcome of this election will affect you directly?
Directly, yeah, certainly. I think probably now more so than ever. Granted, I don't have much of a long political life to base that on, but at the same time, I think everyone in this room, just based on the amount of turnout from the students that we have here, we know the stakes are high. It's very serious. The issues are deep and real, and you know, we're in a dangerous time right now, but in times of danger, there's also great opportunity, and if we can use that to our benefit, hopefully we can build a better world than the one we're inheriting right now.
Sid, same question.
The fear card, my friends. The fear card.
He's playing the fear card?
I think so. I think the McCain camp does that as well. See, I don't hold back. We have 20 days left. Just to let you know, I'm not going to hold back any longer. I'm sorry to put people off. But, you know, part of the reason why I think this is such a big election is because we have been fed information that is completely along the wrong lines of what we need to hear and what is really honest rhetoric. And, you know, the fear card is something that I think is ridiculous, personally.
Well, before you play politics like that,
okay,
what's at stake in this election for you, do you think?
Stake? Wow, if you look at the three big issues, our standing in the world, our continued foreign policy is something that we should all be concerned about. Drew's concerned about it as well. I'm personally concerned about health care and, of course, rising college tuition. That's something, you know, most of us in the room are concerned about.
And we're going to spend the entire second hour of this show, as you may know, on rising college tuition and Obama's and McCain's plans for making college affordable as segment 18 in our 30 Issues in 30 Days series. That'll be next hour. Members of the audience, if you're willing to raise your hands and declare, who here knows, well, first of all, who here is registered to vote? Almost everybody. Who here has ever voted before? Oh, a lot of people. Okay. Who here is willing to declare and say you're voting for Obama? I would say probably two-thirds of the hands. How about for McCain? Very few in this room. But I think there are some undecideds. Are there undecideds? Okay. Undecideds. A handful of undecideds. Drew, see those undecideds out there? Can I see those hands one more time? Okay, there's your target audience. Give them your best shot in 60 seconds.
Okay, I can be honest. This is not a Republican year. There is a significant chance that the Republicans will lose even more seats in both the House and the Senate. And if that is the case, if Obama is elected president, then you will be having all three branches of government controlled by the Democrats. For a very long time, this has been a center-right country. 56% of people polled still consider this a somewhat conservative country. I think the map's changing a little bit, and it will be the challenge of the Republicans to figure out how we want to adjust to the 21st century, and I think John McCain is the right person to do that. No person has showed more bipartisanship on Capitol Hill over the course of the past 20 years than Senator McCain, and for that bipartisanship, people respect him. And pretty much a lot of the major problems that we have facing our nation, if you get people together, if you get the most of the Democrats in the Congress and 10 Republicans, you can get a lot of legislation passed. McCain will be a good check on the Democratic Congress, and I think you'd see a lot of successful legislation passed if McCain becomes president.
The problem here to you undecideds is when you invoke bipartisanship, his policies that he's advocating will not entail bipartisanship. Look at foreign policy. 82% of this country thinks we're on the wrong track, largely because of what we're involved in across the seas. So my argument to your undecideds is big. Think bigger. We are in an increasingly interdependent world where our actions in the United States will influence the rest of the world. So in my opinion, the big picture is what we need to consider. How does a person in Beijing, a little child in India, view the next president of the United States? With respect, admiration, and deference, that's the person we need in office. And I'm sorry, but if you look through McCain's policies, there's not a lot of difference if you go through Bush. There's not a lot of difference, especially on foreign policy. There's not a lot of difference, and people know that there's not a lot of difference.
All right, let's see those undecideds hands one more time. Now, who's willing to – I see fewer hands than I did before. Did anybody just get convinced? Nah, 60 seconds was too short. Okay. We have one of those undecided voters right there. Tell us why you're undecided. Actually, you want to identify yourself first?
Ryan Kennedy from Garden City High School.
All right.
I don't know a lot about the candidates.
Are you going to watch the debate tonight?
Yeah.
What do you think you'll be watching to see?
Basically, like, what they're going to do about college tuition.
You're concerned about college tuition?
Yeah.
Have you watched the previous debates?
I watched the vice presidential one.
Anything that stands out to you from that?
Not really.
Not really? Sarah Palin winking? Think she was winking at you?
Yeah.
She was, huh? All right. We have another undecided voter over here. Hi there. Identify yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Danny Pomerantz.
Where do you go?
I'm a Hofstra Law School student.
Uh-huh, great. And you're still undecided at this late date?
Yep.
How come?
I don't really see either candidate really taking a clear position on a lot of the issues. At the previous two debates, they seem to have, their own political preferences. I don't just see them mapping out a clear way of solving a lot of these issues, so I'm still not sure of which candidate.
So what will you be watching for tonight? What could either of them say here at Hofstra that would sway you one way or another?
Well, I want them to show more concretely certain steps like healthcare legislation and other reforms they're trying to do, like see in action instead of just, you know, voicing their ideologies, their preferences. I want to actually see practical steps for them to put this legislation into effect.
Anybody here following the financial crisis in the news? A lot of people. Okay. Over here on this side, can you explain what the financial crisis is about in 30 seconds?
Okay. Well, basically, a bunch of big banks like AIG, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns. Well, Bear Stearns already went down in smoke, and basically the government needed to pass a $700 billion bailout plan to give to the CEO so they could bring back their companies, because in the views of the federal government, if they don't do that, then the entire global economy will fail, and for that reason that they think that that's worse than sort of taking a little bit out of capitalism.
That was awesome, man. What's your name? Where do you go?
My name is Lucas Gallardo, and I go to Hofstra. I'm a freshman.
Give him a round of applause. Who thinks the financial crisis will affect you personally? Why? Anybody whose hand is up, who's willing to say? Over here. Hi.
Hi, my name is Marie Graham, and just in terms of work, I am a law student, and for the first time in 21 years, I'm not working. Part of it was because I switched from a job from New York City to Long Island, and it was just right at that point. And I actually have big law school loans, and I have two kids, so I'm wondering about that.
Anybody else? Who else thinks the financial crisis will affect you personally? We have some people right down here in the front, if you don't have anybody closer to your microphones. We have, by the way, a bunch of round tables here with, I guess, about 8 to 10 people at each table. Say we have, what, 100, 150 people in the room? It looks like they should be serving you breakfast. I am sorry, folks, that nobody served you breakfast. At least orange juice or something. There is coffee, so that's good. College runs on coffee. Hi, identify yourself, please.
I'm Katie Sestarsik, and I go to Hofstra. It's going to affect me because I'm a senior, and I'm looking for a job in the spring. I'm a publishing major, and when people don't have extra money, they're not spending money on books, so most publishers are cutting jobs and not looking for anybody else. So I might be out of luck finding a job.
Anybody's parents freaking out over the financial crisis, talking to you about it? What are your parents saying, and who are you?
Hi, I'm Dave Schuchel. I'm a grad student at the New School.
Mm-hmm. And what are your parents saying to you?
Well, I know from talking to my mother that her 401k has lost tremendously, at least 25, if not 40% in value. And if the credit crisis continues, there's a good chance that a lot of that money won't be recovered by normal market functioning.
And so does this leave you wanting anything in particular from the government?
I'd like to see the people whose greed and speculation caused this crisis, I'd like to see them held accountable.
You want to see revenge?
No, I don't want to see revenge.
Justice?
I want to see a system that works. This one doesn't.
Will holding them accountable help your parents' retirement funds?
That would be a first step. I think there's bigger questions there, though.
All right. Someone in the back? We have with the other microphone. Where are you? Hi. What's your name? Where do you go?
My name is Adam Peck. I'm a junior at Stony Brook University, further down on Long Island. My dad actually, he right now is putting two students through college, and so obviously his 401k is incredibly important to him and his family. So that's something that he's been following closely, and we've talked about, and you know, something that he's deeply concerned about in this upcoming election.
Does it affect his vote, or had he already decided?
He had already decided. Our entire family kind of already decided. But you know, this economic crisis kind of solidified his opinion about who he'll be voting for in November.
Drew, McCain supporter, what do you think will go wrong if Obama wins?
What do I think? I am not a McCain supporter who's going to bash Obama. I think Obama has a lot of promise as a politician. He's energized the youth in this country in a way that I could have never anticipated 4 years ago, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. However, I think this is McCain's time. McCain was pretty much built for this moment. He has a unique life experience and story that can really help us get through these next 4 years. I don't think he'll run for two terms as president. I think he'll run for one term, and I think he'll try and get as much accomplished in those 4 years as he possibly can.
You think Sarah Palin's qualified to be president?
That's an interesting question, and I think there are people laugh at that, but people who do laugh at that are also minimizing how much of a reformer Sarah Palin was. If you look at Alaskan politics that have been so corrupt, and she talks about this old boy network in Alaska, it's alive and real, and she deserves a lot of credit for shaking the system up. And I do believe McCain in some ways has a true partner with what he'd like to apply to Washington.
Sid, what will go wrong if McCain wins, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, I believe that McCain, although he is a decent man, is probably deep down embarrassed by some of the campaign that the negative externalities of his campaign. I think he's embarrassed by his campaign in general. Anyways, that's a cheap shot there. Sorry about that. Let's talk about Iraq. Let's talk about I could give you guys numbers, but the fact is that can anyone point to what would potentially be the successful strategy in Iraq? Can anyone honestly articulate why McCain's policy is going to lead to a free Iraq or stability within region? Not you, Drew. It's hard to point to a reason, not because we're all unaware of the issues, but because we have seen a trend over the past 6 years. This is not a short period of time. It's 6 years. 6 years. And he doesn't spell out a clear possibility of when we're going to get out of the region. That's scary when we're not considering the overall strategy, but rather tactics. The surge is a tactic. Implementing more troops in Iraq is a tactic. But finding out where terrorism is, where the central battlefront on the war on terror is, that's a strategy. And that's what will go wrong in the McCain administration.
Last thing for you guys, then we're going to take a break and bring on some other guests, keep talking to everybody else in the room. 70 or 80 million people are expected to watch tonight. That's more than for the Super Bowl or the American Idol final or The Daily Show's best episode ever. What does McCain have to do to win the debate tonight, Drew?
He's got to put all the chips on the table. He needs a game changer right now. John McCain needs to go out to the country and tell each and every one of us that he is better suited to handle this economic crisis than Senator Obama. Is that possible? Who knows? That's a tough hill to climb. But at the same time, he needs to come out with a true strategy tonight, and he's got to change the game. Tomorrow morning, if people aren't talking about how well John McCain did in that debate last night, it will be President Obama.
Sid, what does Obama have to do to win tonight?
Well, Obama, first of all, McCain's plan, what he can do is spell out the $52 billion tax cut plan that he has. I mean, that's something that voters might state that, you know, that voters might like about McCain. Obama has to come back and stay his head above water. He shouldn't be too attacking. He should just basically keep it calm and keep cool. And that's what he's done throughout the last two debates. It's hard to tell me and look me directly in the eye that Obama doesn't know what he's doing up there.
Shouldn't keep it too cool, though, right? People think he's aloof sometimes. What does it mean to Hofstra that the debate is here tonight, Sid?
It means everything. It means that, well, you know, we're the center of this nation right now, as you can see by all the media outlets.
3,000 media people. Did you see that stat?
I didn't see that.
Unbelievable. What does it mean to Hofstra, Drew?
It's amazing, especially as a local guy. You know, I grew up as a little kid going to the Hofstra football games, and I've seen this university grow each year. It's a tremendous credit to all the people that put so much hard work in building this university, and we have a unique opportunity here. You know, we're changing politics, our generation, be it left or right, and we're at the center of this, guys, and the change is coming regardless of the
Democratic.
Yeah, change
is coming, man.
Hey, it's going to come, and as a generation, this is serious, as a generation, I hope we can fundamentally change the politics in the ways generations prior have hoped to, but they didn't. And this is a good starting point, and I'm so pleased that people at Hofstra are getting involved. It's really a true credit to all the students here.
Well said.
Live at Hofstra University on this morning of the final presidential debate here. Please thank Siddhartha Nathan and Drew Bennett from the debate team and from Poise. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More in a minute. From Hofstra University, scene of tonight's presidential debate, Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Hofstra students and faculty here at Dempster Hall. By the way, you can see our online video picks on our website. This week's picks include comedian Jackie Mason's rebuttal to comedian Sarah Silverman's YouTube hit, The Big Schlep, one of our picks last week. Did you see that Sarah Silverman video? She's trying to inspire a parade of young Jewish Obama supporters, many from Long Island, to go lobby your grandmas and grandparents in Florida. Jackie Mason's goal, to rain on Sarah Silverman's parade. That's our online video pics at wnyc.org/video. Anyone here see that Sarah Silverman video? A handful. Anyone actually go on the Great Schlep? Just curious. With us now, Larry Levy, Executive Director of the National Center for Suburban Studies here at Hofstra and former columnist for Newsday. Ashwini Anborjan, a reporter and editor for Feet in Two Worlds, an immigration reporting project of WNYC and the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School. And Matt Taibbi, Rolling Stone Magazine's chief political correspondent and author of a new book called The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics, and religion at the twilight of the American Empire. Wow, they know how to title books over there. Welcome to all of you. Hi. Larry Levy, I saw a poll about a month ago indicating John McCain had a slight lead on Long Island. Think that's still the case?
Nope. The financial crisis kind of changed everything. I mean, if 3 or 4 weeks ago the explosion wasn't on Wall Street but it was at the Mall of America in Minnesota, the numbers might be reversed. The public may have focused in more on McCain's perception of being a leader in time of war and military, but that faded. And what we had was an explosion on Wall Street, and it helped propel Obama to where he is. And along with it took Long Island, because Long Island is, of all the suburban areas in the country, is probably the most directly affected by what happens on Wall Street. Tremendous number of people in Nassau County, where Hofstra is, work in financial services that bring their money back to Long Island. So if anybody was cynical about the bailout package, you can think of it as a Long Island bailout package, because it's certainly going to help.
Why would Long Island be swing voter country at all? This is downstate blue New York.
Well, Long Island is similar to a lot of suburbs in the country, which at one time were, what we used to say, rock-ribbed Republican. And they have since shifted more toward middle or even slightly toward Democrat. It's happened for a couple of reasons. One is demographic change. People have moved to Long Island, either from the cities or directly from other places. A lot of minorities, a lot of new immigrants, who brought their Democratic or left-leaning politics with them. And there's also been a shift ideologically. And a lot of suburbanites who are fundamentally moderate, middle-of-the-road type people, they tend to shy from extremism of any stripe. They have seen the shift in the National Republican Party on many issues, moving harder to the right, and they felt uncomfortable, so they have moved. But in local politics, this is still very much a swing area. The county legislature is still 10-9, and if a charismatic Democrat were not running for county executive, a Republican would have a very good chance to win.
Ashwini, the first two debates, by all measures, have benefited Barack Obama. A new CBS New York Times poll out this morning gives him a commanding 14-point lead, 53-39. Anything over 50% for a presidential candidate is really good at this point, and 53-39 is really good. And it indicates that the attacks being mounted by the McCain campaign are backfiring. Set the scene politically as you see it going into this final debate.
I mean, I think that our two panelists beforehand put it actually pretty well, that it's on John McCain. What does he have to offer to the American public in terms of real, tangible solutions? It doesn't matter anymore if someone knew a radical in the 60s when they were, in Chicago, because this is about the fact that Citibank is pulling out of every university in this country. You cannot get student loans. It's much harder. It's about the fact that there are foreclosures. It's about the fact that, my parents, too, lost several 20 to 30% on their 401ks. There are real economic hardships happening. And the thing is that John McCain has a great opportunity tonight, because no one really thinks that Barack Obama has explained the situation that well either. So the question is, can he show a fluency on the economy? Can he connect, and can he convince people that the solutions that he's offering, the ideas of lower tax cuts, allowing people to take money out of their 401ks, that's great for seniors. Can that actually help people have a better economic future? And does that actually mean that 5 years down the line, a year and a half down the line, that when you open your 401k statement, the money's going to be there again.
Matt Taibbi, your book is called The Great Derangement. What is The Great Derangement?
Well, the book is it's sort of about how people have become turned off to mainstream politics. So they no longer believe that the government can really deliver any real solutions for them. So they've tended to drift into increasingly sort of conspiratorial or paranoid politics.
It's really ironic, isn't it? Because, of course, you finished your book before the financial crisis hit.
Right.
Here, everybody is putting all their faith in government. Government is the buyer of last resort, even of equity shares in the banks. And everybody's saying, like, God, if it wasn't for government, you know, we'd all be broke.
Yeah, well, except that people don't really have a choice at this point. I mean, this has been sort of a nation held hostage. Wall Street has essentially put a gun to America's head and said, if you don't bail us out, the entire system's going to collapse and you're going to lose everything. I think a lot of people, I mean, I was just in Colorado covering a local election there. There's a tremendous amount of suspicion out there about this bailout. I think a lot of people are thinking, well, we're going to have to give this a shot. We don't have a choice. But the suspicion is that both parties are actually colluding to bail out the people who finance their political campaigns, and that this is not going to be a real solution at all.
Let me ask the room, since most of you, you know, are at least somewhat aware of the financial crisis. You don't have to have a real well-formed opinion on this. I'm not going to ask you to argue it. But do you think the bailout bill was worth our $700 billion? Or if you were in Congress, would you have voted against it? Who would have voted against it? Very few. Who would have voted for it that you're sure of? More, but not that many. How many of you just don't know enough really to say? A lot of hands didn't go up in any of these categories. What question am I missing?
Also, what version are we talking about?
Well, the version that passed.
Okay.
But if people are so suspicious of government, why wouldn't that help John McCain? The Republicans are the party that are always saying government is evil. And the Democrats are more the party that says, look, government does things well, does things badly. We have to, you know, try to make government better, but government is important.
Sure, that would be a normal response in maybe a different time. But John, we've just had 8 years of Republican rule, and John McCain is very closely aligned with this president. And in fact, this financial crisis has a lot of ties to people who are very close to John McCain. I mean, his campaign co-chairman, Phil Graham, is a guy who passed an amendment to a law back in 2000 that essentially deregulated the market for credit default swaps, which was one of the major, major causes of this crisis. And so John McCain is, you know, I'm not saying that Barack Obama, of course, is not, you know, part of the Senate that was guilty of inaction during this entire crisis, but McCain is directly, intimately linked with a lot of these problems, and that's why he's suffering right now in the polls.
All right. Larry Levy from Hofstra, formerly from Newsday. Here's an entry on our comments page from someone in the hall. Rachel from Dempster Hall writes, the bailout's goal is to restart movement of the credit markets at the top. The bailout is not going to help save finance jobs on Long Island.
Well, no, I didn't say that. I said that a lot of people go into the financial services industry. The big money is what comes back from the folks who commute to Wall Street. 30% of Nassau County residents commute to Long Island. They bring back a disproportionate amount of income. There are some financial services jobs on Long Island. They're backroom jobs. They don't tend to be directly related to trading, what actually happens on the floors. But what happens in New York City in general has a tremendous ripple effect on Long Island. So I think it would have a major, major impact on Long Island.
Ashwini, why isn't John McCain winning, in your opinion?
I mean, where do you start? Look, there's lots of reasons, right? There's the fact that Democrats have an edge right now. Let's not forget, just a month ago, John McCain was pulling even. So there was a huge financial crisis and predisposed thoughts about Democrats or Republicans, who can handle this crisis better. People do trust the Democrats more when it comes to the economy. They're not sure about the plans that have been put forward. So, I mean, and that level of trust was there even before. But then you had that. You had Sarah Palin. I think that there's, you know, these new polls that are out, the CBS poll, the Bloomberg LA Times poll, men and independents are moving towards Obama in large numbers that hadn't been there before. And if you want to look at Sarah Palin and the trust factor there, I think that that vice presidential choice probably did influence that, you know, those people in moving towards him. And once again, it's about your pocketbook. Who are you going to trust more? It's not about national security anymore. It's not about the surge. It's not even about the fact that there was a major terrorist bomb in Pakistan during the Democratic convention, wasn't it, Brian?
Right about.
Right. And we're not talking about any of those things. Those are things that John McCain did talk about really well, but it isn't there. He set himself up pretty poorly when it came to the economy anyway, because he didn't push it. He didn't put forward a lot of proposals ahead of time. You know, you have to give Barack Obama credit. He's been talking about regulating Wall Street from when I was covering him back in September of 2007. So it's been a long time that he's been on the stump talking about these issues. So he had an advantage going in when this financial crisis happened. But I think this has really is what has tipped the election in his favor.
Audience, whose impression of John McCain has changed over time? Anybody here who could say that you started with one kind of impression of John McCain and that it changed over time? We have a bunch of hands up here. And so the mic is arriving right over there. Hi, who are you?
Hi, I'm Emily Cummins. I'm a student here at Hofstra.
And?
I really supported John McCain. I voted for him in the primaries. And about in July, he sort of just seemed to, you know, change where he was as a conservative. He was someone who was, everyone hates the word, but he actually fit that profile of being a maverick. And then all of a sudden, he decided that he wanted to be really conservative, try and reel in all of those people that were saying that he was too weak on a lot of issues. And when he specifically chose Sarah Palin, I completely lost all faith in him. So right now, I'm an undecided voter just because I didn't previously like Obama, and now I guess I've lost faith in the party that I aligned myself with.
You used the word maverick. What does it mean to you?
To me personally, it means someone that looks beyond party lines and just tries to solve the issues.
Another hand about John McCain and your impression of him changing over time.
Hi. I'm Eric Appelman. I'm a senior here at Hofstra. And basically, like, when I first, like, I've known John McCain for a couple of years. I mean, like, back, like, in 2000, I would have considered him a maverick, but, you know, but when he announced his candidacy, you know, he came up as a war hawk. But nowadays, all I see is basically a Wall Street apologist. And it's, like, a bit, he's regressed a bit, and it's a bit disturbing.
We have one more in the back.
Yeah, my name's Andrew Lessington. I'm a senior here at Hofstra. And, you know, looking in the cast and John McCain on immigration, climate change, campaign finance, the case and skill of rights on health care. You know, there were a lot of things that he had done in the cast and compromised on and reached across party lines on that made me, you know, maybe think about at one point, maybe supporting him. But now, I mean, especially on the tax cuts, he, in 2001 and 2003, he opposed the Bush tax cuts. And now he's backtracking and supporting them when he had already said that they would collude in deficit and that they weren't for middle-class people. So I feel like he's gone away from where he used to be on those issues. Immigration, too.
Thank you very much. Can I flip the script here? Whose impression of Obama has changed over time? Who's gone from point A to point B on Barack Obama? Either way, good, for good or bad. Yeah, right down here.
Hi, my name is Malcolm Malone, MBA student here at Hofstra. When Obama first came out, I thought he was a bit inexperienced, but through time of reading his platform, I've become more comfortable in supporting him.
Anybody else? Right over here.
One thing that I have yet to see is a real vision for what to do with the economic crisis. I mean, he's been running as a centrist, but there's almost a degree of Wall Street apologism in his campaign as well. And it's clear from the pressures that we face, next year that's not going to cut it.
All right. Listeners, audience members, I'm curious. Who can name three media sources that you go to for news? TV, websites, whatever. How about the woman right there with you, Lisa? Hi.
Hi, my name is Sarah Cazzotti. I'm from Stony Brook. And most of the time, if it's not the New York Times, it's CNN or it's my Yahoo news mail, the easiest online. Yeah.
Do you have my Yahoo set up to give you certain kinds of stories or certain kinds of sources?
Yeah, sometimes you filter it, you know, but I just like to get the general news from, like, everything.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a Facebook profile?
Of course.
Do you ever use it for political content or interaction?
Only when it's, like, really interesting or when it's big, you know.
Like what? Can you think of an example?
Like, the latest one was when, what's her name, Sarah Palin, couldn't name the few, you know, newspapers and stuff that she read, and I got a whole bunch of, you know, messages and stuff like that. Did you see her? She's dumb and all this.
Oh, yeah. She couldn't name any magazines.
She couldn't name any magazines.
I read all of them.
Yeah.
Name one. I read all of them. Okay, who else? What media sources do you go to for news?
I'm Rachel Hatt. I'm a student at Queens College. I read The Nation. I listen to your show just about every day. I listen to Democracy Now! Most mornings, read The New York Times.
Now, the opinion media that you mentioned, Nation, Democracy Now!, Slanted Left, anything that you read from the right?
I have actually gone on the National Review a fair amount just to kind of get an idea of what they're doing. However, I don't really feel that Democracy Now! And programs like that, it's really just kind of giving you a better picture of like how the economy is affecting working people.
Do you ever use Facebook or any social networks for political content or interaction?
Yes, I do some political organizing on Facebook.
How do you do it?
Well, it's a really great way to get the news out about events and, you know, like Power Vote in New York City. We've been organizing here at Hofstra to get the word out about clean and just energy. We promote events. We have Facebook groups. We do a lot. It's great.
That's great. Someone else? One more about media? Hi.
Hi. I'm Sonia Gassin. I'm a law student here at Hofstra, and I listen to NPR almost every morning on my drive to school, and I also sometimes read The Economist. Sometimes I read Mother Jones. Sometimes I read The New York Times. Sometimes I read The Guardian. Usually I go to print sources online, though, instead of picking them up in the store. But I like to get a lot of different varieties of news sources and sort of compare them. I don't really like a lot of mainstream newspapers. I almost never watch the news on TV.
Thank you. Matt Taibbi, your book is called The Great Derangement, and the subtitle is A Terrifying True Story of War, Politics, and Religion at the Twilight of the American Empire. What do you mean, Twilight of the American Empire?
Actually, my editor came up with that subtitle, so what he means. I think, you know, this is sort of the waning days of, the America's, global dominance, I think. I think we're sort of looking at that historically. There's a lot of things that are going on in America now that remind me of things that happened in other empires in their last days. I mean, we saw a lot of, people turning towards fortune tellers and superstition and fundamentalist politics and at the end of the Russian Empire, for instance, where I lived in Russia for 10 years. So this kind of reminds me a little bit of that. I think we're at the edge of our hegemonic days.
Larry Levy, how would that language go over with most people on Long Island? I realize there are many different groups on Long Island, but comparing us to the end of the Russian Empire.
Suburban areas in general tend to be, as I said earlier, moderate, middle of the road, and the people that you're talking about, in the book are not the folks who tend to decide elections. There are 80% of the country is pretty much locked up before you even pick the candidates. They're going to either vote Democrat or they're going to vote Republican. And it's that 20-25% in the middle that need to be persuaded. And those are heavily suburbanite places like Long Island. Because we're a blue state, unfortunately, what Long Island does isn't going to count for very much, except maybe in state Senate races and in the assembly. But it's places like, this year it's Nevada and it's Colorado and it's Florida and Ohio and Virginia and maybe Missouri. And beyond that, you don't really have to look at anything. And it's the suburbanites, the people outside the central cities, which are going to vote Democratic, and outside the hard red rural areas, which are going to vote Republican, who will decide this election.
You teach here at Hofstra. Are there many students who are the first in their families to go to college?
Well, lucky for the students, I don't do much teaching here. I run the National Center for Suburban Studies, There seems to be a tremendous interest in the worlds that they come from. I think a majority of our students probably are suburbanite, and they seem to be a little bit more interested in what's going on in their particular communities. And suburban problems are often the same as city problems, but they take on a different cast and they usually require a different solution. So we're finding more and more interest.
We'll continue in a minute. Hear from Hofstra, scene of tonight's presidential debate, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. When we continue, we're going to talk about race in the campaign and other things. Stay tuned. And don't forget, tonight we will have a pre-debate special and a group blog that you can join at debatecompanion.org. I'll be hosting the pre-debate, which begins at 8 o'clock, and you can participate in our group blog during the debate along with WNYC political director Andrea Bernstein, on the media host Brooke Gladstone, John and Adora from The Takeaway, and me. That's WNYC's final debate coverage tonight on WNYC and debatecompanion.org. And we'll continue live from Hofstra here in a minute. From Hofstra University, scene of tonight's final presidential debate, Brian Lehrer, live with you on WNYC with Larry Levy, executive director of the National Center for Suburban Studies here at Hofstra and former columnist for Newsday, Ashwini Amburujan, a reporter and editor for Feet Into Worlds, an immigration reporting project of WNYC and the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School, and Matt Taibbi, Rolling Stone magazine's chief political correspondent and author of the new book, The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics, and religion at the twilight of the American Empire. Ashwini, what role do you think race is playing or could still play in the outcome of the election?
Well, if you read the Wall Street Journal the other day, they said there was no Bradley effect, so maybe none whatsoever.
Bradley effect being that some white people tell pollsters that they're going to vote for the black candidate, but then they don't.
Right. I think that it's being overstated. I think that with what's happening in the country now, that yes, it creates great headlines to, sort of see a Sarah Palin rally where people are yelling terrorist or liar or whatever it might be. But I think that there is a tendency on both sides by vocal groups to yell a lot of names and to make a lot of accusations. But voters in general, I don't think that you're really seeing, a great shift or anything where voters who aren't going to, who are letting really race really sway them. Because if they were, you wouldn't see the numbers where they were in places like Ohio. You wouldn't see the poll numbers start to move away from John McCain in a state like West Virginia. I think that the actual effect of race is far more negligible than what's made out to be based on some of the reporting and some of the attacks, I think, by the vice presidential candidate mainly right now.
Matt, you want to disagree with that?
Well, I think I would agree that it's not known yet how much of an effect it's going to have at the polls, but I think it's clearly the cornerstone of the Republican strategy right now is to make a race-based appeal to their voters. I mean, I think...
Really? When people at McCain events bring up Reverend Wright, he won't go there.
Well, McCain personally, no, but there's through surrogates, there have been any number of different avenues that they've pursued to try to get to the race question. I mean, you heard Sarah Palin, actually it was while I was in Colorado a week and a half ago, say that Barack Obama is palling around with terrorists and that he is a person who doesn't see America the way, quote, you or I do.
You think that's racially coded?
I think all white people can understand exactly who she's talking about when she says you or I. Don't forget also that this Bill Ayers business also has a very strong racial component. Bill Ayers was a figure in the 60s who was known as sort of a traitor to the white race because he was a white radical who aligned himself with the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army. So there's that history there, too, if you scratch the surface of that whole line of attack that race is underneath there as well. There's also this whole business about ACORN now coming out, this black housing affiliate group. So the Franklin Rains commercial where they tried to associate Barack Obama with Franklin Rains, the former chief of Fannie Mae, where there was only a very tangential relationship there. It just seems to me that this has been the strategy that they've tried to pursue more than anything else, because they don't really have a whole lot else to run on right now.
Audience, same question. What role do you think race or racism is playing in this campaign? Any of our students from Africa maybe want to chime in on how this looks for you? If any of you are from who are from Togo, I know you're originally French speaking. Maybe some of you speak enough English to want to chime in on how this looks to you here coming from there, or anyone else on race as a factor in this campaign. Hi, all the way in the back.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth DeVold from Garden City High School. To me, race does have a factor, and I think it is an issue that, while some people say is overplayed, I don't think it's overplayed at all. I don't know if you guys heard about the issue with some ballots in some states, how they printed Barack Osama on some of the ballots by accident. To me, call it what you want.
I hadn't heard that one. You think that was an accident?
To me, yeah. I mean, the association's there. You can't deny it. And I don't think it's a manifestation of the Republican campaign. I just think it's the way it is. It's just the association's there.
Who else? Does anybody here? Oh, we have somebody. Go ahead.
Well, I actually find that we've been witnessing a change in the electorate because, as many of us have been noticing, we're able to vote this year. And as we found, many of the new voters are more racially tolerant because we're used to this. We're used to being able to see anyone of any race as an equal. And as a result, we're looking more at what the issues are instead of what race is.
Youth vote. You think the youth vote is more racially tolerant in general?
Yes, because we have seen, we've been taught, we've learned from all of the past experiences where race has been in the way, and we have been able to look past that bias in a better way than previous generations.
Does anybody here disagree with that? Anybody here disagree that we're trending more tolerant over time with the generation? Yes, gentleman all the way in the back.
How are you doing? I'm Robert. I'm a senior here at Hofstra. I disagree. I think in the back of everybody's mind, race comes down to it, no matter what. Like, we have all learned everything. We've learned as much as we can, but no matter what, I think race comes down to it at the end.
Anybody on
it's
the
just
panel?
Human nature.
Agree or disagree, Larry Levy?
Well, if you accept the premise that the suburbs are going to be the swing vote, and if you accept the statistics that show that many suburban areas in the country are among the most segregated communities in America, race is going to be a factor. But I think the economy has become so huge, it has just elbowed, blown away, whatever cliche you want to use, it has just blown everything else out of the water. It's transcending race. It's transcending other issues for better and worse, economy, sustainability. It's all about the economy. And if you go around the country and you talk to people, you're going to hear the less than coded racial appeals, but you're also going to hear a lot of people say, you know what, I'm voting for the person who I think who's going to lead me out of this mess.
So at least it's possible in America for these white suburban voters who you study to trust the black guy more on the economy than the soldier.
Well, it's the black guy who went to Harvard, who has a specific plan versus a soldier who has a different plan. But it comes down to Barack Obama has just connected. I know that's a vague word. But he's just connected better with people empathetically, passionately, and also with specific policies than John McCain has.
Can I ask, and this is my question, though, about the idea of that connection. If voters were not open-minded, do you think they wouldn't be able to do that? I mean, I know that there is a financial crisis. I know that there's no question that there are some racial, there is a racial strategy that the Republicans are desperately trying to maybe push through some Republicans. But I do think, though, that Barack Obama won primaries. He won millions of votes. He won in a state like Iowa that has no black population. And there's no, and he won in Wisconsin, he won in state after state. And it's just that if American voters are not open-minded at this point, there's just not a possibility that this candidate could have come this far. And that's why I think that, you have to look at what people are doing, you have to look at what campaign strategists are doing, and not buy into it so much that, you know, those people out there are going to be so easily swayed. Those people out there have already had a chance to vote.
Back to
and
the
be
audience.
Part of this primary.
Hi, who are you?
Oh, it's Marie Graham. Well, I do believe race is a factor. It's not the number one factor because, as one of the panelists said, Barack Obama is very, very educated. But the point I'd like to make is part of the belief is that he had to be more than qualified in order to get all those votes, in order to connect with everybody, for everybody to see him as a candidate that can make the decisions that will help this country and get us out of some of this stuff.
Matt Taibbi?
Yeah, I think I agree. I think this is a historic election in the sense that we've finally reached a stage in our history where we're tolerant enough to not only accept a black president, but to reject the kind of coded racial appeals that have been winning elections in this country for decades. I mean, you go all the way back to Nixon with the silent majority, and he ran all these commercials about law and order that had these images of urban black America that were good enough to scare enough white people in suburban America to win elections. He had Reagan with his welfare queens. He had Willie Horton. You had the immigration debate after that. All of these were coded racial appeals that won elections with a majority of American voters. And it's going to fail this time. And that's going to be a historic moment in this country. They may never use them again.
Change is possible.
Yeah, exactly.
Matt Taibbi, Rolling Stone Magazine's chief political correspondent and author of the new book, The Great Derangement. And Ashwini Anburjan, reporter and editor for Feet in Two Worlds from the New School in WNYC. Larry Levy, executive director of the National Center for Suburban Studies here at Hofstra, former columnist for Newsday. Thank you all very much. Please thank our guests. We continue live from Hofstra. We will talk about student loans as an issue in the presidential race.